Chapter 3. Pasteur's Memoirs of 1857. Louis Pasteur, the son of a tanner, was born at Dole in 1822. Intense strength of will, acute worldly wisdom and unflagging ambition were to be the prominent traits of his character. He first came into notice in connection with crystallography, by discovering that the crystalline forms of the tartrates are hemihedral. His son-in-law has recorded his jubilation over his early achievement, and has told us how he left his experiment to rush out of the laboratory, fell upon the neck of a curator whom he met accidentally, and then and there dragged the astonished man into the Luxembourg Garden to explain his discovery. Work so well advertised did not fail to become a topic of conversation, and the news eventually reached the ears of M. Biot. On hearing of this, Pasteur wrote to ask for an interview with this well-known scientist, with whom he had no previous acquaintance but upon whom he now showered every attention likely to be appreciated by the rather misanthropical old worker, whose influential patronage undoubtedly became the first contributing factor in the triumphal career of the ambitious young chemist. All the same, Biot's persuasions never succeeded in gaining Pasteur a place in the Academy of Science. This he obtained only after the former's death, when nominated by the mineralogical section, and then, oddly enough, exception began to be taken at once to his early conclusions on crystallography. This, however, was not until the end of 1862. Meanwhile, in 1854, Pasteur was appointed professor and dean of the new Faculty of Science at Lille. In 1856, a request for advice from a local manufacturer of beetroot alcohol made him turn his attention to the problem of fermentation, which was then exercising the minds of the learned. His observations were interrupted by a journey to Paris to canvass for votes for his election to the Academy of Science. Obtaining only 16 and completely failing in his attempt to enter that select circle of academicians, Pasteur returned to Lille and to his study of fermentations. In spite of the work done by Cagnard de la Tour, Schwann and others, the idea was prevalent that animal and vegetable matters are able to alter spontaneously, while the authority of the famous German chemist Liebig carried weight when he asserted that yeast induces fermentation by virtue of progressive alteration in water in contact with air. Another German named Ludersdorff, so we learn from Bechamp, had undertaken experiments to prove that yeast ferments sugar because it is living and organized. An account had been published in the fourth volume of the Traité de Chimie Organique, which appeared in 1856. Now let us examine Pasteur's contribution towards this subject the following year, since at that date popular teaching assigns to him a thorough explanation of fermentation. During 1857, Pasteur left Lille to work at the École Normale in Paris, but we are not here concerned with his movements, but simply with what he had to reveal on the subject of fermentation. His son-in-law tells us that it was in August 1857, after experimenting in particular with sour milk, that Pasteur first made a submission on lactic fermentation to the Scientific Society of Lille. Be this as it may, we find his extract from a memoir on the subject in the Comptes Rendus of the French Academy of Science, 30 November 1857. The entire memoir was printed in April 1858 in the Annales de Chimie et de Physique, and from this latter we gain full details. The experiment consisted of Pasteur taking the substance developed in ordinary fermentation, nourished by sugar, chalk, casein or fibrin, and gluten, an organic matter occurring in cereals, and placing it in yeast broth, a complex solution of albuminoid and mineral matters in which he had dissolved some sugar and added some chalk. There was nothing new in the procedure. As Bechamp points out, it was the same experiment that Liebig had undertaken some 16 or 17 years previously. However, unlike Liebig, he did not ignore microscopic examination, and so made observations that had been missed by the German chemist. Thus Pasteur is able to tell us that a lactic ferment is obtained which, under the microscope, has the appearance of little globules, which he named lactic yeast, no doubt because of their resemblance to yeast, although in this case the little globules are much smaller. In short, he saw the minute organism known today to be the cause of lactic acid fermentation. Now let us go on to his remarkable explanation of the phenomenon. He tells us that it is not necessary to introduce the lactic ferment in order to prepare it, as it takes birth spontaneously, as easily as beer yeast every time that the conditions are favorable. This assertion surely demonstrates Pasteur's belief in the spontaneous generation both of beer yeast and of that which he called lactic yeast. It remains to be seen what the favorable conditions are, according to his teaching. he tells us before long. These globules of lactic yeast take birth spontaneously in the body of the albuminoid liquid furnished by the soluble part of the beer yeast. There is certainly nothing in this to overthrow the general belief in spontaneous generation. But, in fairness, we must not overlook a note that he added to the full edition of his memoir, as we find it in the Annales de Chimie et de Physique. Before this account appeared in April 1858, Professor Bechamp, as we shall find, had provided the French Academy of Science with an illuminating explanation of the origin of ferments. In the face of Bechamp's irrefutable views, Pasteur may have thought it only wise to add a proviso to a memoir that from start to finish has no solution whatever to offer as to the appearance of molds except as a spontaneous origin. Therefore, by the sentence, it lactic yeast takes birth spontaneously as easily as beer yeast, we see a star and, looking below, find a footnote in which he says he uses the word, spontaneously, as the expression of a fact, but reserves the question of spontaneous generation. Certainly any denial of it is completely excluded from this memoir, with its assertion of the spontaneous appearance of beer yeast and lactic yeast. Where Pasteur differed from other spontaneparists was in omitting to attempt any explanation of such a marvel. His followers, ignoring the confusion of his views, have seized upon the concluding statement in this same memoir as a triumphant vindication of the correctness of his teaching, since he said, "Fermentation shows itself to be correlative of life, of the organization of globules, not of the death and putrefaction of these globules, still more that it does not appear as a phenomenon of contact." But this was only what others had said and had gone some way to prove years before him. So devoid was he of proof that he had to make the following admission in regard to his hypothesis that the new yeast is organized, that it is a living being, namely, "If anyone tells me that in these conclusions I am going beyond facts, I reply that this is true, in the sense that I frankly associate myself with an order of ideas that, to speak correctly, cannot be irrefutably demonstrated." We have therefore in Pasteur's own words his confession of his non-comprehension of a problem that the experiments of Professor Bechamp had already, as we shall shortly see, solved with an irrefutable demonstration. The reason why Pasteur should get the credit for demonstrating that which he admitted he could not demonstrate is as much a puzzle to anyone insisting on historical accuracy as was, apparently, the phenomenon of fermentation to Pasteur. However, we will not deny ourselves a thorough examination of his work, and so let us now consider his memoir on alcoholic fermentation, of which his son-in-law, M. Valery Ridot, tells us that Pasteur said, "The results of these labors on lactic and alcoholic fermentation should be put on the same lines, for they explain and complete each other." We find the author's extract from this latter memoir among the reports of the French Academy of Science of the 21st of December 1857. Pasteur's procedure in this experiment was as follows. He took two equal quantities of fresh yeast, washed in water. One was left to ferment with pure sugared water, and after having extracted from the other all its soluble part by boiling it with plenty of water and filtering it to get rid of the globules, he added to the limpid liquor as much sugar as he used in the first fermentation and then a trace of fresh yeast. He expressed his conclusions as follows. "I am just establishing that in beer yeast it is not the globules that play the principal part, but the conversion into globules of their soluble part, because I prove that one can suppress the globules that are formed and the total effect on the sugar remains sensibly the same. Thus certainly, it matters little if one suppresses them by means of filtration with the separation of their soluble part, or if one kills them by a temperature of 100 degrees and leaves them mixed with this soluble part." In view of the fact that he was supposed to be discussing the hypothesis that yeast is organized and living, there was so much that was extraordinary in this that he pauses to reply to inevitable criticism. "But how, it will be asked, can the fermentation of sugar take place when yeast is used that is heated to 100 degrees, if it is due to the organization of the soluble part of the globules and these have been paralyzed by a temperature of 100 degrees? Fermentation then takes place as it does in a natural sugared liquid, juice of the grape, of sugar cane, etc., that is to say, spontaneously." Here is seen the prevalent idea of spontaneous alteration, though Pasteur goes on to state that, "In all cases, even those most liable in appearance to drive us from belief in the influence of organization in the phenomena of fermentation, the chemical act that characterizes them is always correlative to a formation of globules." His final conclusions are held up for admiration. The splitting of sugar into alcohol and carbonic acid is an act correlative of a vital phenomenon, of an organization of globules, an organization in which sugar plays a direct part by furnishing a portion of the elements of the substance of these globules. But, far from understanding this process, we find that Pasteur admits 3 years later, in 1860, "Now in what does this chemical act of decomposition, of the alteration of sugar consist? What is its cause? I confess that I am entirely ignorant of it." In any case, the critical mind inquires at once, how can fermentation be explained as a vital act by the operation of a dead organism, or by the conversion into globules of its soluble part, whatever that may mean, or by spontaneous alteration? No wonder that Bechamp comments, "Pasteur's experiments were so haphazard that he, who acknowledged with Cagniard de la Tour the fact of the organization and life of yeast, boiled this living being to study its soluble part." Indeed, Bechamp's account of Liebig's and Pasteur's closely allied work is well worth perusal in pages 56-65 of Les Grands Problèmes Medicaux. The chief point to be noted is that as Pasteur made use for these experiments of substances with life in them, such as yeast broth, etc., they could not, in any case, furnish evidence as to the foremost question at stake, namely, whether life could ever arise in a purely chemical medium. That problem was never so much as touched upon by Pasteur in 1857. If we had only his explanation of fermentation, made during that year, we should indeed have a strange idea of the phenomenon. We should believe in the spontaneous generation of alcoholic, lactic and other ferments. We should be puzzled to understand how fermentation could be a vital act and yet be effected by dead organisms. Of the air-borne origin of ferments we should not have an inkling, that is, as far as Pasteur was concerned, for either he was ignorant of, or else he ignored the truth already propounded by others, particularly by Schwann, the German. Pasteur passed over with slight allusion the contacts with air that were involved in his experiments, because his aim was to disprove Liebig's theory that the alteration of yeast broth was due to an oxidation by air, and he seems to have had no idea of the important part that air might play, although for a very different reason from the one imagined by Liebig. Clearly, in 1857 Pasteur was a sponte perist, without, however, shedding light upon the controversy. The housewife, puzzled by the souring of milk, could have learned from him only that living globules had put in a spontaneous appearance, the same explanation that had been generally accepted many years earlier to account for the maggots found in bad meat, until it had occurred to the Italian, Francesco Redi, to keep flies from contact. Here the reader may interpolate that Pasteur's vision, although still obscured, was gradually piercing the fogs of the mystery. But, as it happened, those fogs were by this time entirely dispersed in other quarters. Bechamp's Beacon experiment had already shed much light on the difficulty. In 1855 and in 1857 there had been presented to the French Academy of Science memoirs that were to become the lodestar of future science, and it seems high time that now, nearly a century afterwards, credit should be given where credit is due in regard to them. And here let us turn to the outcome of work undertaken in a quiet laboratory by one who, perhaps unfortunately for the world, was no adept in the arts of politics or advertisement and was too much immersed in his discoveries to be at that time concerned about his proprietary rights to them. Let us again open the old French documents and see for ourselves what Professor Antoine Bechamp had to say on the subject of fermentation.